Hello, I'm Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 1338. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 13. This is being recorded on August 3rd of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to introduce my new co-host, Monty, who, I think you've got a pretty good idea from the previous 10 interviews. The other two are about to be put up later today, just how good Monty is. And I'm sorry if that embarrasses you, Monty.
No, it's a genuine privilege to be here. And before we get started, I'd like to clarify something that you and I spoke about off air. And that's my references in the previous program that we did to the LaRouche organization. I wasn't quoting doctrinaire Lyndon LaRouche propaganda or information. I was simply stating that by 1969-1970 time period, the American Nazi Party infiltrator Roy Frankhauser was actually working for Lyndon LaRouche. That's what I was referencing.
Yeah, I misunderstood that. So the mea culpa is mine. Again, one of the dynamics of my relationship with my late dear friend Mae Bussell, she would use some of Lyndon LaRouche's material. And, you know, as I said, some of his more sophisticated work, like the Executive Intelligence Review, can be quite informative up to a point, but sooner or later, it all tracks back to, you know, it's for the Jews, yeah? And so that was a problem there. But again, it was not a misunderstanding. But anyway, you know,
if I may clear that up, I'd like to quote from a 18 December 1987 Washington Post article, you know, just to clear some of that up.
Sure.
Yeah, but by 1979, Frankhauser became a security consultant for political activist Lyndon LaRouche. And once again, this is from Washington Post, 1978, published by John Mintz, a last name M-I-N-T-Z, John Mintz. And this is 18 December 1978, Washington Post. Frankhauser became a security consultant for political activist Lyndon LaRouche in 1979 after Frankhauser convinced LaRouche that Frankhauser was actively connected to U.S. intelligence agencies.
Which, by the way, there was an article, excuse me for butting in, but in the 1980s, I might have been in the Cleveland Plain Beaver, I don't remember, but in the mainstream press, where Frankhauser worked on a contract basis for CIA and I think also NSA. And again, contract doesn't mean, you know, like taking out a contract, you know, blowing away. But it means rather than being a career civil service employee, like a GS, whatever, he right. signed on to do a particular, job or to work for a particular time with them. So yeah, that absolutely is true. And, that might serve as something of a transitional element to one of the major focal points of not only our shows last week, but also some material we'll be presenting today. And that is the fact that, you know, you hear about the far right, right? I mean, they won't say fascist. I mean, that is just, you know, not a term they'll use. But the far right, this, the far right, it looks like Thomas Cook, who I think was actually the patsy for the shooting attempt on Donald Trump. But I don't think they ever intended to kill Donald Trump. I think that's why they killed Thomas Cook. But he was apparently, you know, a far-right, you know, anti-Semitic, anti-immigrant, basically of a fascist persuasion. And I suspect that's where they got onto him. And but they never talk about about fascism. They talk about the far-right this, the far-right that. And one of the real lessons to be learned about the JFK assassination, and beyond that, moving forward, is that the stay-behind operations, the use of fascist elements, in the case of Europe, actual veterans of World War II, fascist veterans, Italian fascisti, Greek fascists, German fascists, they were used as the stay-behind networks, and yet, for NATO, but one, the U.S. is the most important NATO country. And yet, to believe the official record, we have no stay-behind network. Stay-behind refers to the ostensible network of the fascists in Europe to serve as armies to harass the Red Army in case of an invasion of Western Europe, which, you know, the Red Army never intended to do. It would, none of us would be here if they had. It would have been a nuclear war, but,
Right. And I'm so glad you pointed out the NATO Army intelligence aspect of this, because pivoting back to Frankhauser and what I believe, fervently believe, and this is, you know, just my own personal observations on this. Can I prove any of it through documentation? Unfortunately, no. But from what we see from Frankhauser and his activities surrounding, you know, not only leftist, but far right organizations here in the United States, I'd like to pivot back to Frankhauser and what he's doing in the 1950s and how that may overlap him as being some kind of sheep-dipped Gladio operative. And he may not be unique. I want to stress to your listeners, I don't believe that Roy Frankhauser is unique in this sense. I believe he's representational of several cells that are penetrating leftist and right-wing organizations in the 1950s to set up a Gladio-type stay-behind apparatus here in the United States. So if I may, I'd like to expound on some of that and quote directly from a book called, this book is called Nazis, Communist Klansmen, and Others on the Fringe by John George and Laird Wilcox, if I may.
It's excellent, and we'll proceed in just a sec, but I want to remind people that one of the foundational elements in this discussion is the 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place address in New Orleans, occupied by Guy Bannister's, quote, detective agency. And it obviously was an epicenter for intelligence activities, anti-Castro activity in particular, but it also was an epicenter of overlapping elements of the far right. Maurice Brooks Gapman, for example, one of Garrison's investigators, was the attorney for George Lincoln Rockwell in the hate bus incident.
Right.
And he also discussed channeling about $100,000, which is a whole lot more money in the early 60s than it is now, to French fascists associated with the OAS to overthrow or eliminate de Gaulle. So one of the really important things to be learned from a real proper investigation of the JFK assassination is that that address used by Lee Harvey Oswald was, as you put it, a fusion center. It not only was an epicenter of intelligence activity, meaning espionage, not intellect, but also of overlapping elements of the far right, the American Nazi Party, the Klan, the National States Rights Party, the Minutemen, the Christian Defense League. So that is one of the things to be borne in mind. So go ahead, Monty, with that book about Others on the Fringe.
Right. So this is a book called Nazis, Communists, Klansmen, and Others on the Fringe, Political Extremists in America. This is published January 1992. The authors are John George and Laird Wilcox, and this was published by Prometheus Books in January of 1992, and I'll quote it directly about Frankhauser. So this is from a section called From the Army to the FBI, Bomb Suspect Lists. They report, meaning the FBI, they report that Frankhauser joined the United States Army on 6 November 1956 and specifically volunteered for the 82nd Airborne Division in order to be sent to Germany. Now, I want to stop there real quick. If Frankhauser is representational of some kind of domestic Gladio network, I can't think of a better place than one being a member of the 82nd Airborne, because, you know, let's face it, that's the first step in our elite advanced infantry units. It's airborne, ranger, then special forces. But you know, ultimately, he's doing this purposely to be sent to Germany, of all places. You know, that's fascinating in terms of Frankhauser's motivations. Continuing.
Well, by the way, I have a question. The term triple canopy that one hears, that alludes to that triad that you just mentioned, airborne, Army Ranger, and Special Forces, does it not?
Correct, correct. Okay. That's a triple lightning bolt, tip of the spear. Yeah, triple canopy reference to what they call the full stack in United States Army jargon. If you got the full stack, you're the elite of the elite, the cream of the crop. And the basis for that are our airborne units. You know, so specifically, he joins the 82nd Airborne to be sent to Germany. Interesting motivations if he is, in fact, an agent provocateur, or what I believe he is, some representation of a domestic gladio. So continuing with this entry on Frankhauser.
Absolutely.
As a devout collector of Nazi memorabilia, and as well as a Ku Klux Klan sympathizer, even as a young man, Frankhauser soon engaged in a number of half-baked plots that immediately brought him to the attention of Army authorities at Fort Bragg. Frankhauser even developed a scheme to have himself declared officially dead so he could leave the Army and join the neo-Nazi movement, hoping to rise to a position of prominence. 2 July 1957, Frankhauser stated that he planned to desert the United States Army to join revolutionary forces in Cuba. In fact, he went AWOL and arrived in Miami, Florida on 5 July 1957 to do precisely that. He was taken into custody shortly thereafter and returned to his military unit. Army records reflect that Frankhauser was discharged 18 November 1957 under the provisions of AR-635-209, unfit for military service, end quote. I should note that George and Wilcox, the co-authors of this book, also cite a document which was based on a series of interviews that Frankhauser gave under oath on 13 July and 18 July 1957 after his return to Army custody. And I'll report directly, I'll quote directly from that document. Frankhauser made a decision to infiltrate organizations such as the Neo-Nazi Party, the Communist Party. Aha. Look at that clue we get there about Frankhauser and his motivations. Infiltrating not only far right, but far left organizations, the very nature not only of COINTELPRO, but of Gladio type units, infiltrating the full spectrum of extremist organizations to essentially use them from the inside out as false flag reasons.
And
for,
by the way, Lee Harvey Oswald appears to have been in that template in his activities out of the aforementioned 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place address. Go ahead.
Absolutely. So reading again, made a decision to infiltrate organizations such as Neo-Nazi Party, Communist Party, and the Ku Klux Klan to determine their motives, identity, the leaders, and report this information to proper intelligence agencies of the United States government if their aims were ascertained to be instrumental to the interests of the United States government. You know, so by Roy Frankhauser's own testimony that he gave to the United States Army when he was under investigation by the Army, his whole motivation for getting into the neo-Nazi movement in 1957 in Germany was to infiltrate them from day one. That was his motivation. Not only that, but the German Communist Party of all organizations. You know, he's infiltrating both ends of the political spectrum to report on the motives, the identity, and the leadership of these organizations. So already by 1957, he's acting as some kind of gladio-type infiltrator into these organizations. Continuing. Frankhauser advised that he had created a cover story, which included causing people to think that he was a true communist or a Nazi, and the creation of an organization that was to be a large, well-organized unit, but which was comprised of only one man, Frankhauser. Now, Mr. Emery, if I may ask you directly, and I'm trying hard not to be cynical here, who else fits that nomenclature, setting up a leftist organization in which he is the only member? But the ultimate reasoning for doing this is to induce people out of the woodwork to get them to join that organization and then destroy them from the inside out. Well, Lee Harvey Oswald with his Fair Play for Cuba Committee headquarters in 544 Camp Street, where he's the only member of that organization.
But of course, New Orleans was a hotbed of doctrinaire leftist slash Marxist activity. I mean, I'm being facetious. I mean, one of the many things that's so ridiculous about the cover story of the JFK assassination, you have Oswald, the Marxist Marine. Are you kidding me? He would have set the New World's indoor record for death if he'd been an outspoken Marxist in the U.S. Marine Corps. I mean, that would be today, but in particular in the late 50s or early 60s, I mean, it just, It is, to say that it's not credible would be understatement. Go ahead, Monty.
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous. And we have to appreciate that, and this is something I stated in the previous broadcast about Frankhauser and his connections to the National States Rights Party of New Orleans in Louisiana. It should be noted that according to Jim Garrison's investigation, and this is confirmed by Dr. Caulfield, who had access to these reports, one of the editors of Stormfront magazine, which is the publishing wing of the American Nazi Party in 1963, is Carlos Bringer.
Oh, whoa, my Aiken, as my late dear friend Abe Russell used to say, my Aiken A blank blank, as I would say, oh, sweet creeping Jesus. I mean, my God, it just, you know, the Caulfield book is flawed, deeply so, but it also is incredibly useful. And that is an example of the really important information contained there if one makes the jump and links the elements that he sets forth to the intelligence community that he disclaims any involvement with regard to the Kennedy assassination. Go ahead.
Absolutely. As for Frankhauser's motivations, continuing with this Army intelligence report, quote, Frankhauser claims that his aim at Fort Bragg was to get the Klan, meaning the Ku Klux Klan, of the North together with the Klan of the South to give the United States government the opportunity to destroy these organizations, end quote. So ultimately, Frankhauser's motivations for infiltrating the fledgling American Nazi Party and the Ku Klux Klan is as an agent provocateur, and essentially allowing the United States government to manipulate these organizations from the inside out. And for people who believe that, I thought that COINTELPRO was only supposed to infiltrate leftist organizations and destroy them, that's actually a misnomer. COINTELPRO, in terms of FBI and its overlap into Army intelligence operations, did in fact have an operational structure that was infiltrating the far right as well. In fact, we know
the thing about I would a slight disagreement, and maybe this isn't even a disagreement, but it's something that you will refine for us.
Absolutely.
I don't believe that they were actually out to destroy those organizations, but rather to co-opt them and to make sure they didn't do anything that didn't fit
precisely
the agenda.
Precisely.
I mean, this is the same group that not took in Reinhard Galen, but all as we'll talk about in future weeks, General Cesar Arisu.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
And that in turn tracks back to the funding of these groups by the most powerful, the funding of fascism by the most powerful elements on Wall Street. Go ahead, Monty.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you pointed out that Far East intelligence apparatus, because we have to appreciate that is where Mr. Oswald is hired out of. He is not, in all likelihood, recruited into naval intelligence or CIA operations out of either domestic or European ops, as we've been led to believe from researchers that have looked at this. In all likelihood, Mr. Oswald is recruited out of an apparatus that included Far East intelligence. And I'd like your listeners to bear that in mind when I mention the next element of this. Quote, at the time he made these astonishing statements, and I'm quoting once again from the book Nazis, Communist Klansmen, and Others on the Fringe by Wilcox and George, at the time he made these astonishing statements, Roy Frankhauser was 18 years old. After a trip to a U.S. Army facility at Fort Bragg for psychiatric treatment, Frankhauser received an honorable discharge on 18 November 1957. Now, I'd like to note, not only did he fake his own death, according to his own account, not only did he go AWOL in Germany, but he's seemingly infiltrating the Communist Party of Germany and the fledgling neo-Nazi elements in Germany by his own accord. But clearly, late 1957, he receives an honorable discharge from the United States Army after going through, quote, psychiatric treatment, unquote. I have a theory about what's going on here. He was, in fact, recruited into legitimate elements of Gladio stay behind elements overseas. He established his bona fides, and then he was redeployed back to the United States to conduct the same type of operations that he was conducting overseas here in the United States. And the quote unquote psychiatric treatment that Frankhauser received in all likelihood was some kind of enhanced interrogation debriefing of these operations. So I'd like to stress that before MKUltra was absorbed by the CIA in 1951, it was previously an Army intelligence operation called Artichoke. And one of the primary missions of Artichoke, for your listeners that aren't up to spec on it, one of its primary functions was to build up parameters within the human mind, meaning walls that could be chemically and electronically built up or shut down, as it were, to protect information within the human mind, meaning an asset in the field that no matter how much you tortured him or interrogated him, he would not reveal the information unless you had the proper chemical biological sequence to unlock the information. That was the primary function of the United States Army's Artichoke program.
And by the way, this is all a subsidiary or would be grouped under the operational term that we use. I use called mind control. You know, I'm taking the AFA programs, talking about the U.S. intelligence community's mind control programs, AFA program 5, 6, and 7. They were recorded in late 1984. My God, that's 40 years ago.
Right.
I'm getting old in my old age, Marty. Continue.
Oh, absolutely. So continuing, you know, needless to say, Frankhauser's claims to military authorities made after he was returned to the United States Army in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, after having gone AWOL in Germany, are no doubt self-serving. I have a problem with that claim, but I'm quoting once again from this book. Yet he spent the rest of his life shuttling between extremist groups and U.S. government agencies. A 15 September 1975 article by Norman Kempster, last name spelled K-E-M-P-S-T-E-R, and the New York Star, titled, "He Says Uncle Sam Was His Partner in Crime," reported the following, quote, "Although he does not deny sharing his racist views of the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazis, Frankhauser said he joined many right-wing groups at the suggestion of state and federal law enforcement agencies, the FBI, the Mississippi Highway Patrol, and others. He said his associations with law enforcement go back 10 or 20 years. After his discharge, Frankhauser moved back to Reading, but he continued to visit with his racist friends in the South. In 1958, for example, he was arrested in Atlanta for assaulting a policeman during a Ku Klux Klan rally in defense of segregation. At the time, Frankhauser said he was also a member of the far-right National States Rights Party, the NSRP, which had carried out the bombing of a Jewish synagogue in Atlanta, Georgia. At the time, it was called the Atlanta Reform Temple on 12 October 1958. The bombing was just one of a series of attacks on Jewish institutions in the American South. The Atlanta bombing, as well as other attacks on Jewish and Black institutions, led the FBI to focus on Frankhauser as a potential terrorist. He even was on an FBI bomb suspect alert roster. Very interesting. Continuing. It was also during this time period that in the late 1950s that Roy Frankhauser began cultivating connections to the SWP and other leftist groups. That's the Socialist Workers Party. I should note that in 1957, the exact same month that Frankhauser is discharged from the United States Army in November of 1957, Lee Harvey Oswald becomes he actually registers as a member of the Socialist Workers Party and receives their monthly magazine while he's at Atsugi Air Base in 1957. Very interesting.
That again is just, you know, if one takes it on the surface, that is absolutely not credible, because if he were working as a radar operator in the Marines, working on the U-2 project, which is a top secret CIA and military program, and he registered as a member of the Socialist Workers Party, again, he'd set a new world's indoor record for death. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Correct. And here we have one of the men that apparently is involved in terrorist bombings of Jewish synagogues in Atlanta for the Ku Klux Klan and the National States Right Party, Frank Hauser. Oh yeah, and he just so happens to join the states, I mean, excuse me, the Socialist Workers Party.
Yep. And by the way, a background element against which this should all be perhaps measured or conceived of,
Right.
the use of infiltrators into organizations like the Klan has also raised has precipitated information that a lot of those infiltrators also actively participated in many of the crimes. Perhaps the most famous is Gary Thomas Rowe, an FBI infiltrator into the Klan in the South, and
That's
he
right.
appears to have been involved in the murder of Viola Liuzzo, a white woman who was active in the civil rights movement in the South and was shot to death by the Klan.
Yes, sir. Once again, I'm glad you pointed that out. And as a precursor to all of this, or I should say perhaps as an accelerant and where this is all leading, because as listeners to your program where I'm the the co-host will realize most of what I'm talking about has some kind of slant on the Kennedy assassination. And as I'm sure your veteran listeners are aware of, but perhaps new listeners are not. Purportedly, when Lee Harvey Oswald was in New Orleans, well, actually not purportedly, when Lee Harvey Oswald was in New Orleans, leafleting for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and he got in his fight with Carlos Berenguer, the chief propagandist for the DRE in New Orleans, it should be noted that he reported everything that he did to an FBI agent by the name of Hostie, and Hostie himself. In his book, Assignment Oswald, and I believe this is on page 3 of the book, Assignment Oswald, that he published in the 1970s, he claimed to be the commander of all COINTELPRO operations in the American South that dealt with infiltrating the far right. And
And
that was a very.
Oswald, of course, one of the many completely well, one of the things that is not even remotely credible is that Oswald, the quote Marxist-Leninist quote communist, had the Arlington, Virginia name and address of Lincoln Rockwell. Most of his subordinates called him his familiars called him Lincoln Rockwell. His full name was George Lincoln Rockwell,
Right.
the founder and leader of the American Nazi Party, and also that of Dan Burroughs, whose death at the house of Roy Frankhauser in Reading, Pennsylvania, was described as a suicide, but as Frankhauser himself opined, quote, bad case of suicide, three bullets. That's what they said, though, and that quoted in the book The Klan by Patsy Sims. Go ahead, Monty.
Right. So continuing at the Washington Star, September 1975 article by Norman Kempster, training camp. It was during the same time period in the late 1950s that Roy Frankhauser began cultivating connections with the Socialist Workers Party and other leftist groups. Frankhauser would later claim that what he learned during this period would shed new light on President Kennedy's death. Remarkably, Frankhauser promised revelations about the JFK assassination first surfaced not in the pages of the National States Rights Party paper, the Thunderbolt, or some other KKK-affiliated hate sheet, but in the pages of the prestigious New York Times. In a 1 November 1965 article on Dan Burroughs' suicide, the Times interviewed Frankhauser at his Reading home. After telling the Times that he served as a spy for the Virginia White Citizens Council, and in this capacity had infiltrated communist and Negro meetings, Frankhauser declared that soon after the assassination of President Kennedy, he offered to give the Federal Bureau of Investigation photostats showing that the Socialist Workers Party had a training camp with which Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin, was connected. Well, end quote. I should note that once again, I do not trust the New York Times any more than I trust the Thunderbolt. In fact, I keep them in the same camp. They are in fact representational of disinformation milieu that comes out of intelligence, Western intelligence.
By the way, the New York Times is the CIA's number one propaganda asset. And if they want to strike out the liberals, They send the New York Times to the mound, and they give him two high hard ones right over the middle of the plate, then a slow curve off the outside corner, and the Liberals swing and miss every time.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that in 1965, they trusted Roy Frankhauser's word that Lee Harvey Oswald was connected to some kind of commando training camp run by the Socialist Workers Party is fascinating. I mean, it's just fascinating and ludicrous. But that's the validity of the New York Times for you in 1965.
The notion of the Socialist Workers Party having a commando training camp, again, everybody at that, quote, commando training camp, if they were legit, would once again set a new world's indoor record for death. I mean, there's no way.
but ultimately, this is what I'm getting at. The very nature of what Frankhauser is doing, infiltrating the state's rights party, infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan, making his way into the anti-Castro elements surrounding Carlos Berenguer, has all of the effect of a false flag propaganda affront to blame leftist organizations for the murder of President Kennedy, because Lee Harvey Oswald had, in fact, as early as 1957, received the publications of the Socialist Workers Party. I mean, it has all the elements of a joke, you know, and it would only be funny if it did not include, oh yeah, a coup d'etat waiting in the wings, which is exactly what happened on the 22nd November 1963, a military coup d'etat. And this is what Frankhauser represents. He is putting out a false flag narrative about Mr. Oswald that was picked up by, of all publications, the New York Times.
The publisher of the Warren Report. Marvin, pivoting briefly to contemporary events, one of the things that I would be willing to bet was going on in Butler, Pennsylvania, with basically fascist Thomas Crooks allegedly having fired a shot at Donald Trump. Perhaps he did fire the shot. But I am convinced, you know, the notion that people could have seen him on the roof, they were filming him with their phones, and the Secret Service did nothing. I mean, that is so ridiculous. I think, I am convinced, that infiltrators of the Roy Frankhauser ideological ilk within the Secret Service were helping to set this thing up, and that there are some indications that Crooks was not actually killed by a Secret Service sniper, but was shot from behind. And I think he was, rather like Lee Harvey Oswald, he was the decoy, as Senator Russell Long, played by Walter Matthau in the movie JFK, suggested.
Well, once again, everything that you just described, Mr. Embry, is so representational of how Gladio cells are set up in Europe in the late 40s and early 50s, and it is so representational of everything that Roy Frankhauser is doing in the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, this is simply a continuity of tactics,
yep.
Okay? And in all likelihood, the continuity of milieu, you know?
the Republicans in the far right, many of them, by the way, former Navy SEALs, Army snipers, they're saying, no, this was the Democrats and the leftist deep state, which is a joke. There is a deep state. It sure as bloody hell ain't leftist. But they did this, you know, they were going to kill Donald Trump. If for the sake of discussion, the quote deep state unquote wanted to kill Donald Trump, first of all, they could give him cancer. Donald Trump would be seven different kinds of dead right now. Now, this was intended to inflame the far right, so that they will themselves undertake a program of violence against the quote left. I mean, thinking of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as the left is quite amusing in and of itself. Go ahead.
Well, beyond that, I just want to say this much as a personal annotation to everything that you're stating. It just demonstrates the supreme levels of cynicism that these people have. Ultimately for the American public, because let's face it, there were innocent bystanders, or at least one innocent bystander that was murdered, you know, in that attempted assassination. I mean, it's just disgusting, but that is ultimately the nature of the beast that we're examining here. You know, it is just absolute supreme levels of cynicism. They could care less about the American political system or the representational freedoms in it, but they will manipulate that structure in order to get what they want, and it's fascism that they're looking for.
That casualty could be thought of as a sacrificial lamb in order to give credibility and to energize the forces that I think will be undertaking a program of assassination, terror, what have you.
Right. And I just want to say this much. Of all people, he was a fireman. You know, the innocent bystander that was killed was a fireman. I mean, I still remember being a child, you know, of like 5 or 6 years old, and I wanted to be a fireman as a kid. You know, it's like, come on, a fireman is killed? I mean, it's just ridiculous, you know?
Firefighters are in and of themselves very heroic people. There's a quick editorial.
Absolutely.
He made, whether or not he was actually selected, and I think that's a possibility, he certainly made a very useful martyr for the cause. And anyway, I'm trying to interject some of these things. When I saw that go down in Butler, Pennsylvania, I said, you know, no bleeping way could that have happened. And it's obvious that elements within the Secret Service and perhaps within the Butler PD and I suspect strongly the Trump campaign themselves were of the Roy Frankhauser minted stripe, so to speak. And I think that's what happened.
Oh, absolutely. Moving forward with Frankhauser and his associations within the 82nd Airborne, I find it fascinating that just a few days after Frankhauser purportedly was acting as an FBI informant in 1967, because Frankhauser did, in fact, have a relationship with Jim Garrison, only in the sense that Frankhauser appears to have infiltrated Jim Garrison's office, just as did many other far-right reactionaries out of the same 544 Camp Street milieu. It is an established fact that two people who ended up working as investigators very early on from Jim Garrison included Bernardo Del Torres and Jerry Patrick Hemming. And real quick, for once again, veteran listeners and for new listeners of your program, Bernardo Del Torres was the chief of intelligence for Brigade 2506, which was the invasion task force run by the CIA during the Bay of Pigs invasion. It was codenamed Operation Zapata. He worked as an investigator for about 3 months until Jim Garrison found out that he was stealing files. Jerry Patrick Hemming not only was a member of Marine Corps intelligence in the Philippines, where he purportedly met Lee Harvey Oswald in Subic Bay, but later on, he worked with the pro-Castro effort and then became an FBI and CIA informant and then worked for the anti-Castro effort, where he founded a death squad called the Intercontinental Penetration Force, or Interpern. And one of his lieutenants in Interpern was later Watergate burglar Frank Sturgis and David W. Ferry of the International Anti-Communist Brigade's infamy, and of course one of David W. Ferry's cadets was Lee Harvey Oswald. You know, so consider that milieu for a moment. You know.
By the way, Bernardo de Torres, for people who'd like to follow up on this, in the book "Let Justice Be Done" by Bill Davey, there's good discussion of de Torres, who may very well have been present in Dealey Plaza on 11-22-63, and I believe that he also had some links to the Pinochet regime in Chile. I'd put the question mark by the last one.
Correction on that. Not only was, or as an addendum to that, his connections through the Pinochet regime are fascinating because the chief of covert action in Mexico City in 1963 was David Atlee Phillips. So Bernardo Del Torres was reporting directly to David Atlee Phillips. And during the precursor operations to the overthrow of Salvador Allende in September 11th, 1973, David Atlee Phillips was the chief of the Western Hemisphere Division. Okay, and he oversaw the coup d'etat against Allende that installed Augusto Pinochet and his fascist dictatorship. And it should be noted that the chief of covert operations in Chile during the coup d'etat was Bernardo de Torres's superior officer in Brigade 2506, David Sanchez Morales, commander of Operation 40. So, yes, Bernardo de Torres had a capstone, pinnacle position in the overthrow of Allende in 1973. Purportedly, he was a bagman to several of the generals that helped overthrow Allende. And I'll just leave it at that. Continuing with Frankhauser, though, and the infiltration of District Attorney Jim Garrison's office. I'd like to quote from a 1967 FBI summary on Frankhauser and how the FBI first became aware, purportedly officially first became aware of Frankhauser. This is a report made by Frankhauser to Special Agent Davies of the FBI, dated 28 June 1967, if I may quote it in its entirety.
Sure.
Quote, Frankhauser claims he has information of value to the New Orleans DA Garrison in his investigation of Kennedy assassination. PHT1, that's informant T1, stated on 31 March 1967 that Roy Frankhauser had expressed his desire to get his, meaning Frankhauser's, files and records, which are in a secure place but not readily available, some letters from a man named Payne, and that's phonetic spelling, Payne. We're not too sure which Payne is referenced here, but continuing. Frankhauser states that he intends to send the New Orleans District Attorney Garrison for his assistance in the investigation he is conducting into the assassination of President Kennedy. Frankhauser did not say what connections these letters had with the assassination, if any. Informant T6 advised 5 April 1967 that Rory Frankhauser intended a meeting of about 60 to 75 people in Medea, Pennsylvania, on 23 March 1967, at which he publicly stated that he had given information to two FBI agents concerning the assassination of President Kennedy. He said he had offered to testify before the Warren Commission, but was never called because the FBI suppressed his evidence, which they had to do with a man named Payne. Once again, that's phonetic spelling, Payne.
Obviously, that raises the question of whether that was Michael Payne and his wife, who were some of the, well, Michael Payne allegedly separated from his wife, but his wife was one of the babysitters for Leah Marina.
Well, it's fascinating on that note that when the Dallas Police Department special investigator, for Pete's sake, what's his name? I forget his name off the top of my head. I should have him in my notes, but unfortunately, I don't have him today. Stringfellow, Don Stringfellow is his name. When he went to the Payne's house on the 22nd of November 1963 and went into the garage, according to Don Stringfellow, there was two filing cabinets filled with files on the Socialist Workers Party members in Dallas-Fort Worth area. And by all accounts, when Michael Payne purportedly met with members of the Socialist Workers Party, seemingly to infiltrate them, he introduced himself as Mr. Harvey Lee Oswald.
Fascinating. Now, am I remembering correctly, Monty, that Don Stringfellow was also a member of an Army Intelligence Reserve unit that was very active in Dallas on 11/22/63?
That's correct. Don Stringfellow was a member of an organization called the 112th Military Intelligence Detachment. And according to Dan Hardway's notes, when he interviewed one of their members, the man who was the chief of operations for the 112th Military Intelligence Detachment in 1963, a man by the name of Colonel Wilhelm Reich. Colonel Reich, when he was interviewed by Dan Hardway in 1978, he told Hardway under no uncertain circumstances that one of the missions of the 112th, through its parent organization, 4th U.S. Army Operations Command, okay, one of their missions was to infiltrate far-right organizations that were involved in treason and far-left organizations that felt that they had a gripe with the United States government. So we can infer that Don Stringfellow was in fact doing his job on that day when he secured those files inside of the Payne's garage. You know, he was simply just collecting on one of his informants. I would stress that that's just a personal editorial inference on my part, but it sure does seem like there's a lot of smoke that indicates that that is the motivation for him securing those files. Continuing. With the FBI report on Frankhauser. Frankhauser said he met with Payne while infiltrating communist training schools in the area. Frankhauser also claims that he met with Russian agents in the apartment of Helena Rubinstein while acting as a double agent. On 13 May 1967, Frankhauser had made further inquiries regarding what he referred to as the Payne letters. Once again, phonetic spelling on that is P-A-Y-N-E. Frankhauser insisted that they had to be in his files because he could be the only, reading again, because they could only be there or in the custody of Ed Lotz, last name spelled L-O-T-Z, and that Lotz had denied them. Frankhauser said that they had been in touch with Garrison and he expected to be subpoenaed. It is very urgent that he had to find these files. Continuing with this material. Informant T1 advised on 16 May 1967 that after an exhaustive search conducted of Frankhauser's corresponding files, that means he did in fact give his information to the FBI, which contained mostly old material including propaganda of many white supremacy groups, but that nothing had been located relating to the assassination of President Kennedy, New Orleans, or Dallas, or anything that appeared to me material Frankhauser said that he had. The name Payne, or any variation thereof, has not been located in any of Frankhauser materials, end quote. Now, if that is true, that Frankhauser did not have any information pertaining to the assassination of President Kennedy, what exactly was pulled from his files? Well, just a few days later, in the same series of FBI files, Frankhauser found the following material, which he gave to his informant. Now, this is, once again, same T1 informant. This is the same FBI agent Davies reporting again on 20 May 1967. Frankhauser located the following material. Quote, a membership card into the Young Socialist League of Dallas of the name of Roy Hoser, last name H-O-U-S-E-R. That's his cover name. As for the second item, it is now a complete letter that the FBI managed to photocopy from one of its informants, dated 23 March 1960. Dear Comrade Barnett, Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, hearing the formation of the Socialist Discussion Club at the University of Iowa through the Young Socialist League and that you were the chairman of, the undersigned sends his fraternal greetings. This is because, like yourself, we are former paratroopers of the 82nd Airborne, and though it is fitting that you should let known that former members of this military brotherhood that you once belonged to are also with you in a youth movement that opposes militarism and war, but which nonetheless may be called upon in carrying out its liberatory task of displays of courage and daring even greater than that required by the paratroopers. And then the following names are reported. George Larrabee, last name Larrabee, L-A-R-R-A-B-E-E, Private First Class, 502nd Airborne Infantry Unit, 82nd Airborne, 1951-1953, Editorial Board Member of the Young Socialists and Young Socialist Supporters National Committee under the name George Payne. Roy Frankhauser still jumps with the Pennsylvania Airborne Rangers, but is only a part of an air rescue branch of Rangers, not the commando end of it. The air rescue team will parachute along with elements of the Civil Air Patrol of New Orleans in assistance to any plane crash survivors, irrespective of their military or civilian status. So clearly, we can infer, Mr. Emery, from these files that the editorial board member of the Young Socialist League and the Young Socialist Supporters National Committee is an FBI informant, and his handler is Roy Frankhauser, whom they were both members of the 82nd Airborne. Both recruited both recruited out of German operations.
Fascinating. You know, one of the things that I get a lot of fresh fertilizer for, I don't generally say this a whole lot, but you know, people say, oh, man, about the left, whatever. There is no goddamn left in this country. No, I mean, no, there is not. You know, going back to Glenn Pinchback, an operations officer at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, who wrote a letter to Garrison warning about, quote, a Nazi, because he encountered some of the people that Garrison was investigating,
right.
some of the Nazis, and he wrote about a communist plot, a Nazi plot, gargantuan in scope, to enslave America in the name of anti-communism. Well, if there are no, quote, communists, unquote, you can't enslave America in the name of anti-communism. And, you know, it just, I won't, we're running low on time in this interview. We'll continue this in our next, but
absolutely.
The notion that, you know, what the left is, I mean, forget about it. As the late brilliant Mort Saul, the political comedian and not incidentally one of Jim Garrison's investigators, noted in his 1976 autobiography, Heartland, quote, the CIA staffs the left. And the one I'll say, they don't have to worry about the right. That takes care of itself. But they do. I mean, it's just, there is no goddamn left, period. And you know, people say, I'm gay, me. Well, great. You know, you look at what's going on now as we're hurtling into, total king hell fascism and maybe even World War III. Anyway, go ahead, Mavi.
Well, on that note, I just want to encapsulate once again what exactly is representational of these files that Roy Frankhauser, while seemingly working as an investigator for Garrison, what it represents. I'd like to stress once again that the editorial board member of the Young Socialist League of America and the Young Socialist Supporters National Committee is a man by the name of George Payne. And his real name is United States Army Private First Class George Larrabee, last name spelled A-R-R-A-B-E. And he is, in fact, a member of the 82nd Airborne who served with Roy Frankhauser, seemingly recruited by him while they are both deployed in Germany. This has all of the earmarks of a Gladio type organization infiltration, not only of the far right, but of the far left in the United States. And that is what I believe is representational of Frankhauser's activities in 544 Camp Street, because who else has these credentials? Lee Harvey Oswald. It is, in fact, a mirroring operation of what Lee Harvey Oswald is doing with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. This is exactly what Roy Frankhauser is doing when he's infiltrating the Young Socialist and the Young Socialist Supporters National Committee. They are establishing bona fides to manipulate these organizations from the inside out and ultimately seemingly to blame them for the assassination of President Kennedy, which I'll allude to in a minute. How much time do we have left here, Dave? Because this is going to be
only about 7 or 8 minutes. So maybe give us a taste and then we'll continue this in our next interview. But we've got 7 minutes left.
Okay, so according to newly declassified FBI files, Frankhauser's role within the Socialist Workers Party, or at least his affiliation with it, may have had roots in reading Pennsylvania's own political history. It should be noted that in the 1930s, Reading, Pennsylvania was the epicenter of the German-American boom in Pennsylvania in the 1930s. Reading.
Oh, Lord. I mean, see, one of the things that's so important about the work you're doing, that shows the not only ideological but operational continuity between the pre-World War II and World War II period and what is taking place afterward. Go ahead, Moppy.
Absolutely. It should also be noting that in the 1930s, Reading also developed strong socialist and communist movements. J. Henry Stump, who ran for mayor of the Socialist Party ticket in Reading 3 times, once in 1927 and 31, a second in 1935 and 1939, and then for a third time in 1943 and 1947. In the 1947 election, Henry Stump, once again running on the Socialist Party ticket in Reading, Pennsylvania, also the dark heart of the German-American Bund, he only lost a vote for re-election by less than 200 votes, which is fascinating. Reading was also...
Reading, by the way, would be...
Right.
the correct pronunciation, R-E-A-B-I-N-G. Continue, Monty.
Reading, thank you. Reading also became the home of the Socialist Party's Darlington Hoops. A lawyer who was a longtime member of the Socialist Party, who ran as the Socialist Party's presidential candidate in 1952 and 1956. I should note that the American First Party also conducted their campaign out of Reading, Pennsylvania in 1952. And the two men that were on the American First Party in 1952 were General Douglas MacArthur, and the man who wrote Mexicali Rose. So what is that man's name? For the life of me,
I don't know.
Mexicali Rose. Let me look that up right quick. The song. It's so odd that these parapolitical connections. But oh, for Pete's sake, who wrote that song? Oh, bear with me here, listening audience. Who wrote the song Mexicali Rose? Oh, Jack Breckinridge Tenney also ran as vice president on the American First Party in 1952, out of which their headquarters was Reading, Pennsylvania, along with General Douglas MacArthur. And just to give you a little bit of Jack Tenney's background, purportedly, not only did he serve as the chair of the Legislative Fact-Finding Committee on Un-American Activities in California in 1941, but seemingly he is the man that by 1943 becomes a representative of Gerald L. K. Smith and the Silver Shirts in California.
Silver Shirts, that was William Dudley Pelley. Gerald L. K. Smith was the Christian mobilizers, as I recall.
Right. But Jack Tenney makes his connections to the Silver Shirts through Gerald L. K. Smith. So it's actually an indirect way that he establishes these connections. Another very bizarre parapolitical aspect to this is that, you were talking about the Allende coup earlier. It's fascinating that Warren Buffett's father, Howard Buffett, was in fact the financier of the American First Party in 1952, which I don't know what to make of that other than it's simply some kind of continuity of far-right extremists with, the corporatist establishment of the United States overseas.
Very, very good, Monty. Yeah. We've got just under 3 minutes left. I just want to remind people to reflect on the present. Bernie Sanders ran for president on the Socialist Workers Party ticket. I think it was in 1980. And people might want to ask themselves why Karl Rove was bankrolling Bernie Sanders' campaign through his American Crossroads super PAC. But I'm sure there's a perfectly innocent explanation. I mean, I'm kidding. But now, Monty, we have just over 2 minutes left. Give us a really, really encapsulated preview of what we're going to talk about in the next interview, because we've got to be really brief.
Well, essentially what I'm trying to demonstrate here is that within this leftist milieu of Reading, Pennsylvania, where we find Roy Frankhauser seemingly absorbing everything he can about the Socialist Worker Party's position in Reading, Pennsylvania, while actively being a representational member, not only of the fledgling neo-Nazi movement, which would lead to the American Nazi Party, but I shall demonstrate in the next program a direct connection between Frankhauser, the National States Rights Party, the Ku Klux Klan, and the World War II German-American Bund. And I will demonstrate clearly that they are World War II era Nazis that are controlling Frankhauser's movements while he is infiltrating the Socialist Workers Party in Pennsylvania as a member of the 82nd Airborne.
That is fascinating, but I personally don't believe in conspiracy theories. But anyway, I'm kidding, of course. This concludes For the Record program number 1339 with a conversation with Monty, interview number 13. This is being recorded on August 3rd of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.